session number 22658, Reel 4.
I wanted to continue on with you telling us your experiences of the training camp that you were to arrive at first of all.
On arrival at the Mugazi camp, being a voyage only sergeant, I was downgraded to a private, which I knew would happen, and so I basically went back to be with the boys sort of situation.
How did that feel, having the stripes taken away?
Well, I knew it was going to happen, so it didn't worry me too much. But that didn't last too long, because the next day I was talking to one of the X-Men. To describe an X-Man as one of the fellows that had come out of action, either wounded or for some other reason, and we looked up to X-Men mainly to get what sort of information relating to action, because as you can realise, we didn't know anything about it at all, didn't have the slightest idea.
What sorts of questions did you ask?
Well, it was just mainly asking them their experiences, and of course once you got them talking, well, you could ask a few questions, but you've got to bear in mind that we knew nothing about anti-tank work, so we couldn't ask a certain question about it. We might have asked about what sort of weapons they use and things of that nature. So in fact, every reinforcement that came into the brigade training centre would look up to the X-Men and find out whatever they possibly could about things in general, particularly the use of new weapons, which I can talk about later on.
Did they sort of clear up any fears that you may have had in relation to actual contact?
I don't know. I couldn't be sure about that, that it would or perhaps certain actions out on the perimeters and things of that nature would be of interest to them. And it was just the tales that whatever they told you, you basically believed whether it was true or not.
If someone had been wounded, for instance, did that stop them from talking to you about their experience at all?
Oh no, they'd just indicate that it was so and so went out and brought them back, or whatever it may be, taking them back to the aid posts and things of that nature. Didn't say much about those that didn't make the grade, but probably made some reference to a burial in the cemeteries at Tobruk School of Business, but that's about all. I wouldn't say too much. And then there were cases of prisoners of war. Some of ours were taken pretty early before they got into Tobruk, because the 24th anti-tank had gone up, or some of them got up as far as Benghazi, and then they got chased back and formed a bit of a Benghazi handicap. But they were taken, or three that I know of, they were taken before they got to Tobruk. And well, it was the last that they saw of those until the cessation of hostilities.
What was the understanding that you had then of the might of the German forces in relation to what you'd been told from some of these ex-men?
There's always a reasonable amount of respect for Rommel's ability, plus the fact that he had the Panzer divisions there, which had were all experienced fellows that had probably been through the hoops in Poland and all those sorts of places, and plus the fact that they had the best equipment that was going at the time, so they didn't have any worries about whatever they did because they knew we were undergunned and things like that. So and generally, there was a reasonable amount of respect between them and us. You didn't ever hear too much about rough treatment and, as far as POWs and things were concerned, but there probably would be cases, but it was hardly ever heard about. So, in other words, it was man-to-man business of a fair fight.
Good sport.
But that was the general, in my appreciation of the situation. So.
What were your feelings in relation to, right, well, we're getting pretty close to this now?
Oh, I don't know. I think one of the main things was whether I could make it. Which that was determined when we went into Alamein. So,
what do you mean, whether you would make it?
Well, whether I didn't have too much spine for hand-to-hand fighting or whatever was going on. But, it was just every now and you'd say to yourself, or you think to yourself, you know, do you think I'll be up to it sort of business? And perhaps I didn't smoke, and I thought, well, you know, when I first get into action, the old nerves are not any good, I might get into the smoking habit. But, anyway, fortunately, I didn't have to worry about cigarettes. But that, you know, they were the sorts of things, you know, young bloke, 19, 20, whatever it was.
Did you have any sort of thoughts about being wounded at all?
No, not particularly. I mean, if a cop won, well, that was it. I'm a great believer in fate. But, I can't say any more about that. No. But
was there ever a time before you went into battle that you thought, well, I may not return?
No, I never thought about it, but I was more concerned about how I'd perform. And that was the main thing, because you had some of this is experience that I had after I'd got in and joined the fellows that had been in Tobruk. The other ones were people that were just passing through the camp waiting to go back to Tobruk, but it was just the fellows themselves gave you the way they talked about things, sort of gave you a bit of confidence. Well, if they can do it, well, we can do it, sort of business. Plus the fact that a lot of them were virtually uncles or fathers to us young blokes, so we were quite prepared to take, or I say generally, few risks that perhaps the older fellows wouldn't take, a bit more consideration to what was going on.
What was your full knowledge then of the situation in Tobruk and its importance?
Of course, the main thing was that they held out for... when I first arrived at the camp, they'd been in Tobruk about 3 or 4 months, and they were holding their own sort of business. So, you know, there wasn't any, it was a straight out siege compared to withdrawals and things of that nature, such as the Benghazi handicaps and things like that, where where people just were every man for himself sort of business. So there was not much control about it. I'm talking about transport and things like that. You just have a big column trying to move down the road as fast as it could, with a bit of control, but it'd be mixed up sort of business. Various units or parts of units moving, and which was evident in when Tobruk fell for the second time, and when we were moving up into the desert, where we. It was just a great column in the road, and on the road, in the road of us. So there wasn't anything like that in the when the siege was on. So I had a reasonable amount of confidence that we're going to hold out.
So did you understand then the importance of Tobruk in relation to the whole region?
Oh, I certainly did. I mean, it was. The rest of let's say the world was we were in strife. The Allies were in strife. Apart from the Battle of Britain and those sorts of things, but Dunkirk and the likes of that, and other parts of France and. When he got into the desert, he hunted us out of the place, and and it had come to a standstill in Tobruk. So that was the main thing, the stopping of that, because otherwise. If he'd got through to Cairo, he'd have got through across the canal, up through Palestine. The Turks would have probably let him get through, and then he'd be into Russia. And so that sort of stopped that move. And for the period, because he nearly had it again at El Alamein. So. That was that part, but as a reinforcement, I think you just did the best you could. You might as well enjoy yourself if you can, because you didn't know what was round the corner.
We started to talk about this because you lost your stripes initially and you were going to get them back, and you'd heard from an X-Man. Tell us that story.
Apparently routine orders came out. This fellow said to me, he said, "I see you got your hooks back." And I said, "I'll cut it out." And he said, "Well, you better have a look at routine orders." So which I did. And then I was instructing for the next day on lesson 13 or something like that, the lying load. It's one of the rifle lessons of how to manipulate from the or how to get to the position of the lying load and all the actions thereafter. So I thought, I don't know too much about this. I don't know how to do it. So I asked to be promoted to the company commander. So I was paraded and I explained to him that I was a boy journey sergeant and I was just learning military life sort of business. I never cracked on that I had been in the militia beforehand, and I thought I'd have trouble instructing the blokes that I knew, that they knew as much as I did. And he said, well, you'll be giving lesson 13 and dismiss. And of course, being in the artillery, whenever you're before a senior officer, well, not NCOs, but of commissioned ranks and that, you sort of clicked your heels. Because in those days, we had spurs, you see, and because there was always this clang of the T-spurs contacting. And he said to me, he said, you can forget about that heel clicking here. So out the door I went. So I just retired, picked up my kit and gear from where the lads were and went up into the sergeant's lines and got myself the manual and away I went.
What sorts of things did the manual contain?
Oh, it was just the old routine about the various positions and how you got from the vertical position to the lying load position and how your elbows were and how the rifle and the like, you see. And then you'd have to do the reverse, but it was all a routine laid down, how to do it sort of business. So that was that. But
so there's a proper way to
get
down on the ground.
Oh, yeah, it wasn't a matter of just throwing yourself on the ground. Of course, there'd be a bit of a difference of a bullet flying around your head. So.
I was wondering whether the rules of lying low were kept.
Oh, and then, yeah, well, particularly in reference to the out rifle ranges and things like that. And I mean, just rifle drilling itself, I mean, there had to be a procedure for everything, particularly quite memorable things on guards where through the inspections when you had live ammunition. There have been occasions when the fellas are in through a particular action of I just forgot the terminology of it, but it was to make sure that you didn't have any ammunition in the rifle. Should a round be left in the breech and you press the trigger, well, naturally there'd be an explosion around, and being in an orderly group on a parade, someone might get hurt. And so there was always correct procedures in how a function had to be undertaken. So that's why, well, just about anything that was done in the forces was a laid down routine, and it had been practiced for years and always been successful, particularly in the gun drills and or any drill dealing with arms of any description. There's always a way of how it's to be done and how it's to be done the quickest way and correctly. So that's the main reason of our the instructions. But because when we arrived in the Middle East, our particular group, we had World War equipment like bandoliers and things like that, whereas the new issues and that were summer types of clothing and things like that, and then fellows used to buy certain articles, particularly putties and things like that, and they used to endeavour to sun bleach them to make them look as though that you weren't a reinforcement, you're an X-Man or something of that nature. So it didn't take me very long to follow suit, and of course this I ended up with the impression that I was an X-Man, not that I did anything or express anything, but it was just the way one sort of dressed, and lots of fellows thought I was an X-Man, that were even in the same reinforcement group that came across. So I just let them be, and that was quite peaceful as far as I was concerned, because there'd be nothing worse than someone saying, what the hell do you know about it? You were in the same camp as we were, sort of business. So that made it easier for me. And
did people find out that you weren't?
Fortunately, the fellows out of our own reinforcement, they never cracked on, never let on, sort of business. So I was pretty lucky. But of course, then there was it was all new weaponry that we had. So which number one, I had to learn about it, and then pass what I'd learned on to the newcomers, because they were coming in quite regularly for the reinforcements.
How regularly were they being brought in?
Well, I suppose they're coming in three monthly or something like that. You know, that'd be a rough idea, because the convoys were coming through fairly regularly at the time, and there was a lot of pardon me, a lot of movement of people belonging to other divisions that were transferred into the 9th Division, and they would be sorted out, and they'd come in as reinforcements. They were reinforcements, but they would have been in another camp or something like that. So there were all those sorts of things that were happening, and so what with new weaponry and things, there was you got more interested from the classes that you were tutoring, whereas if it had been 6 months beforehand sort of business. You're doing the same lectures on the same equipment, you know, weekly or something like that. That'll lose concentration, could get to heaps and hell because they knew how to do it sort of business. So, but with like the Thompson submachine gun, that was a new weapon to all those, and the 2-inch mortar, though it was, I would say it's probably World War One equipment, but we didn't have it in our training and in Northern Camp sort of business. But then there's other interesting field craft and things of that nature, and how the general acclimatisation to the country that we were in and things like that. There's all this interest in that, the best way, how things had to be done.
How long was it then before you received your first new weaponry?
Well, actually, we moved into that straight away. Straight away. I mean, the 303 rifle, and that was a regular piece of equipment, so nobody had any worries about that. Mm. Or had to learn very much about it.
When you started getting this new equipment in, how long were you in the
business? We would have. It was there when we first arrived, okay. And it was just a matter of the new NCOs understanding the procedures associated with the new weapons, and then for them to impart that to the new reinforcements and that. So that was that part of it. But,
can you tell us what the average day was like in camp at Mukazi?
Oh, this is the early morning reveilles and things of that nature, and ablutions, and being on parade, the roll calls, and those sorts of things. And then there's the meal times, and following is depending on circumstances, you may have an hour break after a meal or something, or some specified time, and then there'd be the roll, not a roll call, it'd be another parade, and you'd either be in individual classes, or you may be on a route march or field craft or those sorts of things, where you may be at a lecture by the ex-people. And also because a lot of the senior instructors were originals out of them. Some of them may not have been in action, but I mean they were fully acquainted with what was going on at the time, so they'd be lecturing. And I mean there was gas training drills and all those sorts of things, and the care of equipment and things like that, and security. Things that were of concern to us was the theft of equipment by Arabs, particularly the rifle and that. We were in camps that or tents that were called EPIP tents. They were made in India, and so I think about eight fellows were in allotted to a particular tent, and that was the tent was held up by two big hefty cane-like poles, and your rifles were chained to the posts.